Okay, hi everybody. This is Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 64. I don't know whether it will be 1 hour in length, 1 hour and 15 minutes, or 1 hour and 30 minutes, we will see. These adventures are being put up on Facebook in 15-minute increments, and so perhaps there is something that a wider public can derive from them. But they are pretty esoteric in nature, as you do see. We have finished Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 63. We're starting with 64. We were looking at the three crosses and the idea that esoteric astrology concerns primarily the unfoldment of consciousness rather than personality unfoldment and the unfoldment of events in the life. But it is also true that the personal energies are augmented by the esoteric factors in the chart, the esoteric rulers, and so forth. Well, we will see whether I'm experiencing degraded audio here. Hopefully not too bad. We shall see. Anyway, we move on to Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 64. And he says, we come now to a very interesting point in connection with Aquarius. There is apparently, no planet which is either exalted or falls in this sign. The only planet affected is the Sun. Of course, the Sun is not really a planet, but that which the Sun can stand for as the centralized Ahamkara consciousness, the consciousness of I-ness. The only planet affected is the Sun, whose power is lessened. In other words, the Sun is considered to be in detriment in Aquarius. It is the ruler of Leo, and Aquarius is the sign opposite Leo, so that always indicates a detriment, the sign opposite the ruler. The only planet is the Sun. What is the symbolic significance of this? Well, there are a number of ways to answer this, but I think DK is going to choose perhaps something a little different. It consists in the relation of Aquarius to Capricorn and of the fixed cross to the cardinal cross and of the third initiation to those succeeding it, of the point of balance reached between Pisces and Capricorn, which focus is Aquarius. Now, perhaps we are looking at the possibility that Ahamkara is going to disappear entirely on the cardinal cross, and that Pisces here will represent the cardinal cross, and Capricorn, as the sign of initiation, will represent the end of the process of the fixed cross at the third initiation. He is not considering the usual reasons for this detriment. So the relation of the fixed cross to the cardinal cross is the relationship between the soul and spirit. And when we're dealing with the spirit, we are expanding the identity far beyond the usual sense of self. We're even beyond the sense of being an individual ego on the higher mental plane. That is somewhat dissolving in Pisces. So let's see what other reasons he may give. I am not here considering the orthodox mathematical or astronomical reasons for the various falls, detriments, and so forth, for they are in reality dependent upon the subjective and spiritual reasons, and it is these, and it is with these that we are concerned. DK is always giving a rather deeper understanding of some of the facts that we have come to accept as part and parcel of astrology. He's saying that the normal reasons are derivative of still deeper, more esoteric, more subjective reasons. One of the facts which will emerge in our consciousness as we study along these esoteric lines is that all the outer indications do not indicate truth, but only point the way to subjective realities of which the outer facts are but the illusory symbols. Ponder upon this and keep an open mind. Well, so far he hasn't. He's hinted more than he's given any definitive reason for that question of no rise, no exaltation, no fall, and only a detriment. One of the things we have to understand is that the usual sense of I-ness, the very self-centered, egocentric attitude that we find in the early Leo experience, undergoes a kind of dissolution, a kind of dissolving in the atmosphere of Aquarius, which represents, in a way, all four of the cosmic ethers with their rulership by Uranus. The egocentric attitude definitely dissolves away in the group conscious attitude, eventually leading to the sense of universality. And so that's the question, you know, what is the self when there is a true sense of universality? What is the I anymore? The usual sense of the I is detrimented in Aquarius. That doesn't mean that there's not replacing it a great and expansive sense of the I, of what the self really is. The I am the group, I am the whole, I am the universal. These are deeply true and probably are appreciated by the Aquarian individual, by the advancing Aquarian individual. His sense of self is very expansive and participates widely in the collection of many of the many selves and even of the kingdoms of nature. The sense of universality is strong. So then the normal sense of self, as we find it in Leo, is detrimented or in detriment in Aquarius. At least that's one explanation which I have always found to be relatively convincing. What is the sense of self of the progressive Aquarian? We go from the superficiality of the Aquarian sense of self to the deepening of the Leonian self to the dispersion and dissolving of even that self in the advanced Aquarian attitude. No planet is exalted in Aquarius, and no planet falls in this sign, because the true Aquarian, after due experience upon the mutable cross and the fixed cross, so the true Aquarian is post-fixed cross. The true Aquarian is, as here referred to, is an individual who has passed the third initiation and perhaps even the fourth initiation. The true Aquarian has reached a point of balance. You see, because it says, you know, after due experience upon the fixed cross, does that mean after he has completed the fixed cross? If it means that, then we're dealing with the initiate. The true Aquarian is, in fact, the initiate. Okay, he is held by none of the pairs of opposites, but uses them both for spiritual ends. He is able to understand his expression through personality and through soul. Those are the major pairs of opposites we normally deal with, but we can be dealing with many other pairs of opposites which can be combined in the more universal, holistic attitude of the Aquarian. Yes, holism. Holism, H-O-L-I-S-M. That will be one of the key attitudes of progressive individuals during the Aquarian age, the sense of the whole. And in that sense of the whole, either one of the pairs of opposites is seen as necessary to that whole, and in the inclusive attitude of the Aquarian, no one of the pairs of opposites is excluded. You know, the sixth ray attitude that we often have excludes one or the other. One becomes devoted to a particular target in experience, in one's experience and emphasizes only that. So that's why the sixth ray is called the ray of undue emphasis. And it has no patience or breadth or scope of vision to include that which it considers to be the opposite of what it prefers, what it has targeted. Well, the true Aquarian, not to say that Aquarius people can't be on the sixth ray, they can be very fanatical that way, very idealistic in the early days, and focus on what they consider to be the whole of their attention. But later, of course, they expand. Under Jupiter, they expand. So, after due experience upon the mutable and fixed cross, the true Aquarian has reached a point of balance. He is held by none of the pairs of opposites, but he uses them both. It's a very utilitarian sign. It's got a lot of fifth ray connected with it. It can be very practical in the later days, as much as it can be quite crazy in the early days, and eccentric, you know, off the center. But that eccentricity leads to the right attitude of proper decentralization, and one finds one's identity in a larger wholeness. He is hindered by neither by earth nor water, neither by Capricorn or Pisces. He is not too concrete, he's not too vague, he can comprise both the Capricorn and the Piscean attitude. I mean, so much depends on how we're interpreting Capricorn and Pisces here. We have to find the level at which DK is speaking. He's not hindered by earth, which is the senses of Capricorn. He's not hindered by emotion or some vague mysticism, as in the case of Pisces. He has surmounted the tests of both the processes of incarnation and initiation, so stands free. Well, the true Aquarian, apparently, then. Let's see. The true Aquarian is apparently an initiate of the fourth degree. Fourth degree. Distributing energy and life, symbolized by the two wavy lines. Yes, you know, DK is always changing the levels about which he's talking. Well, look at that whole gamut of developmental possibility. And if we are not aware of the level at which he is speaking, the level of individual development, well, we're just not going to understand the things that he says, because even in the same sign, at an earlier stage of development, one can be very, very different than one is at a progressed stage of development or a much later stage of development. So we have to target the level. In this case, the true Aquarian is standing free. He's liberated. That is the fourth quality of the fixed cross. There's the blinding light of Taurus, there's the fiery pain of Leo, and the bitter woe of Scorpio, and the liberation of the true Aquarian. Okay, so he has surmounted, you know, look at the Capricorn energy, but Aquarius continues it, continues to go higher yet. He's not bound to the earth. He has aviated. He has taken off. He has surmounted the tests of both the processes of incarnation, which doesn't happen until the fourth degree is taken, and initiation, and so stands free. Now, if he's surmounted the tests of initiation, does that mean he's passed the fifth degree? Well, you know, we have to understand what he means by surmounted the tests of initiation, at least certain number of initiations. Distributing energy and life, symbolized by the two wavy lines. So they are lines of distribution. Are they personality and soul? Are they soul and spirit? They seem to have two different sources. But at least I think he can distribute the energies of the pairs of opposites, usefully so, distributing both, distributing energies of both of the pairs of opposites. It is interesting to bear in mind that the progress of the soul, as far as humanity is concerned, one of the four signs of each cross is more important, of more importance than the others. Now that's very interesting. Let's see what he says here. One of the four signs of each cross is of more importance than the other. I don't think he's talking here about the cosmic decanates, because in that case we would have Taurus on the fixed cross. We'd have Scorpio also for Hercules. That's a cosmic decanate, and Pisces on the mutable cross. So he's not talking in that. He's not talking in that way. Each sign of each of the three crosses is related to one of the four kingdoms in nature. Perhaps we're dealing with the elements here. And the preponderance of the ray influence pours through the sign to the kingdom under consideration. Well, one of the four kingdoms in nature, four lower kingdoms, presumably mineral, vegetable, animal, and human kingdoms. One sign on each one of the crosses pouring through. We could relate, let's see, how would we do this? We could relate the mineral kingdom to earth. We could relate the vegetable kingdom to water. The animal kingdom to fire, I suspect. And the human kingdom, which basically is created through a Buddhic impulse, we could relate that to air, since Buddhi is air. Now that we'd have to go into each one of the crosses and wonder whether each earth sign is most related to the mineral kingdom, each water sign to the vegetable, each fire sign to the animal, and each air sign to the human. Interestingly enough, when you look at the symbolism for the human, for the air signs, you find two humans within it. You find the water carrier, and you find the twins. So human symbolism is particularly found in the air signs, and therefore the air signs may be more related to the human kingdom. Each sign of each of the three crosses is related to one of the four kingdoms in nature, and the preponderance of the ray influence pours through the sign to the kingdom under consideration. What does he mean by the preponderance of the ray influence? The ray influence pouring through the sign? In other words, the greater part of the ray influence of a sign goes to the appropriate kingdom? Let's ask. We're asking DK here. Okay. Does the greater part of the ray influence, which comes through any sign, pour through to the particular kingdom related to the sign? Pour through the sign to the kingdom under consideration. Well, let's just say, suppose we're dealing with the mineral kingdom, Taurus, ray 4. Does the greater part of that ray influence pour through to the mineral kingdom more so than to the others? Looking at Virgo, we have ray 2 and 6. Is it similarly so? Ray 2 and 6 don't seem to have much to do with the mineral kingdom. When we come to Capricorn, rays 1, 3, and 7 are coming through Capricorn. And does the greater part of 1, 3, and 7, or the weight of 1, 3, and 7, pour through to the mineral kingdom more so than to the other kingdoms? Let's see if he really deals with this. Each sign of each of the three crosses is related to one of the four kingdoms in nature. And I'm asking according to element. Maybe it's another relationship. According to elements. And the preponderance of the ray influence pours through the sign to the kingdom under consideration. In connection with humanity, the sign of importance on the three crosses is as follows. Okay, so now I think we can see that my assumption here was not correct according to the elements. At least DK is looking at it in a different way. He is saying that in relation, now we'll have to think about this in an entirely different way. In relation to the three crosses, the signs most associated with humanity is as follows. The mutable cross brings us Pisces, the fixed cross brings us Scorpio, and the cardinal cross brings us Capricorn. These three are most related to humanity. This is very interesting. I'm not sure he's going to give us the way that the other signs on the various crosses pertain to the lower three kingdoms. So we have here a very interesting assignment. Pisces perhaps making it possible for the man to focus into the life of the soul on the fixed cross. Scorpio strengthening the man so he can escape from the fixed cross onto the cardinal cross, and Capricorn being the general sign indicating possible initiation on the cardinal cross. Even the fifth initiation can be ruled by Capricorn, as five initiations are, and they have to begin someplace, so they begin with the first. All right, I think it's kind of interesting. I try to speculate upon these things according to my own understanding, reading along, not having remembered everything I read in this book, and find that DK has other ideas. Okay, and thus we learn. In Aquarius, the initiate consummates all that has been achieved in Leo through the influence of the sun. For in Leo, there is an almost unique condition where humanity is concerned, maybe where other kingdoms are concerned, or higher lives, it would be different. As the sun governs all expressions, exoteric, esoteric, and hierarchical, yes, but let's not forget the veils. We cannot forget the veiling, where the sun may even veil Jupiter upon the mutable cross. At least there's a hint there. It certainly veils Neptune on the fixed cross and Uranus more on the cardinal cross. Aquarius, a great sign of consummation. So even though the sun is in detriment in Aquarius, there is a great consummation of what the sun has signified in the life of the developing human being. That sense of self which the sun represents and the broad consciousness that expands greatly in Aquarius. It's only the ahamkaric aspect of Aquarius, of Leo and the sun, which is detrimented in the sign Aquarius. Okay, in Aquarius, the initiate consummates all that has been achieved in Leo through the influence of the sun. For in Leo, there is an almost unique condition. Almost unique? Are there other places where there is almost an equally unique? I mean, is it possible when we look at Cancer that Neptune is triple, just the way the sun is triple in relation to Leo? For in Leo, there is an almost unique condition where humanity is concerned, as the sun governs all expressions, exoteric, esoteric, and hierarchical. It rules the personality, the soul, and the fourth creative hierarchy. Well, we can see that the sun rules the ahamkara. We can see that the sun rules the higher self, the egoic expression on the higher mental plane, and thus the soul consciousness. And the fourth creative hierarchy, he could have said the monad, could he not? But he's giving us a hint here that the monads are members of the fourth creative hierarchy. So, in a way, the sun stands for that monadic nature. Sun stands for the monadic nature expressed through the fourth creative hierarchy. Hence the sun, the physical sun, that which relates, I think, to the personality, is lessened in its power in Aquarius. The personality for the true Aquarian, who is beyond the third degree apparently, is no longer such a factor. It has been dominated. Its ancient authority is over. The third initiation has been undergone, and the light of the personality has been put out or dimmed by the light of the subjective sun, the heart of the sun, influencing the soul. So this is DK's explanation of why the sun, but only the physical sun really, should be detrimented in Aquarius. I guess my explanation was more along the line of consciousness, but This is the true explanation. The third initiation has been undergone by the true Aquarian, and the light of the personality, which is really in a way lunar light, well, it's a combination of lunar and solar, but in the lower turn of the spiral for each, the light of the personality has been put out and dimmed by the light of the subjective sun, the heart of the sun operating through the egoic lotus and the soul consciousness, the subjective sun influencing the soul. There is much to think out here, but little more can be indicated as the curious fact of this triple control by a planet, and really it's a star, but you know, we can also wonder about the planet which the sun veils, the non-sacred second-ray planet, presumably which the sun veils, and its relationship to Leo. Of course, it wouldn't have much place in the higher form of Leo expression, would it, if it's a non-sacred planet? Well, so there is much to be discovered here and much to think out, as the curious fact of this triple control by a planet constitutes one of the mysteries of initiation. The whole reason why the sun as a star should be listed as a planet is a big question in itself. You know, it's somehow the star power must be uniquely able to be expressed through Leo, but a number of other planets are involved, probably Jupiter, certainly Neptune and Uranus, and maybe this, I suspect, this undiscovered non-sacred planet which the sun, for which the sun is a substitute. So, mysteries of initiation. It is tied up with the relation between Leo and Aquarius, for Leo is unusual in having all its ruling influences concentrated through the medium of one planet. DK is not really saying much of an explicit nature here. Leo indicates the height of achievement of the human soul. Well, what do we mean by human soul? Do we mean the our egoic nature, which is an expression of the monad and which was infused by the consciousness of the solar angel in order to help it be the expression of the monad? Do we mean that by the human soul? Or do we mean that part of consciousness which is invested in the personality nature? The kind of consciousness which is really always an extension of monadic consciousness, which is, should we say, down in the personality nature and has to work through the lower vehicles. What does he mean by the human soul? Maybe we can see. Then he says something really interesting. We are apt to think that initiation and liberation are the achievement of the human kingdom and the attainment of humanity, as if struggling upward would bring us to a state of initiation or liberation, and to a degree it is true, but he is reversing our perspective on this and saying this is not the case. Initiation is an achievement and an attained success of the soul, which has at last succeeded in dominating the personality and in manifesting its true nature and character in spite of the personality and the antagonism of the human being intent on his own purposes. Well, we have to think about this very carefully. You know, in what way is the human being an extension of the monad on the higher mental plane, learning to dominate the lunar aspect of himself, the personality, and to what extent does the solar angel, that returning nirvani from a previous Mahamanvantara, helping the human, the monadic consciousness on the higher mental plane do this? You see, all consciousness is really monadic consciousness, attenuated, always subject to various vehicles, the limitations of various vehicles, but consciousness is one. It is the consciousness of being, and it is totally, well, not totally, but extremely expansive on the monadic plane, and undergoes various contractions as that consciousness makes its way into the lower world. So all consciousness is really monadic consciousness. And basically, DK is saying, well, it's not just the struggling human being or the immersed monadic consciousness in the lunar vehicles struggling upward that is making initiation possible, but it is the power of the solar angel as it reinforces the type of monadic consciousness which is focused on the higher mental plane. It is this type of higher consciousness which so stimulates the more deeply immersed consciousness which makes initiation possible. In other words, if not for that stimulation from the higher aspects of ourself, then the lower immersed aspect would not succeed in making its way into the more liberated state. So there's no question that there is aspiration from below, but perhaps that aspiration is an evocation when the lower part of consciousness is invoked by the higher. You know, it's one of those apparently paradoxical statements, but it does really mean that we do need the higher power in order to, for us as immersed monadic consciousness, to really achieve our liberation. It is literally the attainment of certain desired objectives towards which the units of the fifth kingdom in nature have been working for eons. That is, we as souls, we as extensions of monadic consciousness. And, you know, he says here, fifth kingdom in nature. Now, as souls, we are members of the fifth kingdom in nature, and as triads as well. But he's not speaking specifically of the solar angel as the returning Nirvani here, because the solar angel is not a member of the fifth kingdom at all. Solar angel has long passed beyond the confines of the fifth kingdom. It's a member of the fifth grade of hierarchy. So it is literally the attainment of certain desired objectives towards which we, as souls on the higher mental plane, with whatever type of consciousness we have there, units of the fifth kingdom of nature, have been working for eons, and expresses the end of the enforced task and sacrifice and planetary service. Initiation is the end of the task which has been enforced upon us by the higher aspects of ourself. There is something up there, in there, which is stimulated by the presence of the solar angel infusing our consciousness with an aspect of itself, which is forcing the lower consciousness trapped within the personality confines to move upward and forward toward the state of initiation. So without that whip, you know, without that drive from above, we would not, we, the lower part of the higher consciousness, would not be able to achieve initiation. And expresses the end of the enforced task and sacrifice and planetary service. There has been a sacrifice by certain beings called solar angels. They have decided for sacrificial loving purposes to donate a part of their presence and energy to the uplifting of less experienced monads. It is a planetary service, because when the heart center of the monad is ready to open, the solar angels come in. So this service is needed at the time that the planetary heart is awakening. This achievement reaches its goal at the third initiation. And from that time, in other words, that which the solar angels have been trying to enforce, that which the higher part of ourselves, which is the extended monadic consciousness ensphered within the causal body, has been attempting to enforce with the help of the solar angels, that is achieved here, he says, at the third initiation. And from that time on, man, liberated and free, relatively liberated anyway, serves from free choice as a soul, conscious of intent and purpose upon the higher mental plane. At that point, there is atmic resonance, and the man, as the soul, knows the divine plan in a way he could not before. Yeah, well, you know, sometimes DK speaks of liberation as if it occurs at the third degree, and certainly from a certain point of view, consciousness is liberated, so one becomes a true knower, one has experienced the illumination, the enlightenment, the satori, you know. But the total illumination, liberation from the magnetism of form, you know, an effective, willful severing from the demand of form that one re-enter form constantly in the lower worlds, that is not achieved until the fourth initiation. So anyway, the initiate is the product of a higher energy and not of the upward striving, because the upward striving is really an evocation which comes from an invocation by the higher power. Now we have reached the point, let's see how far we are, we can enter the discussion of the decanates a little bit, and I'll just pause here for a moment to bring up a different chart which is needed. Okay, I always enter this question of the decanates a little bit warily. He says it is a fluid and undetermined area. The intuition is definitely needed here. There are some parts of this material we just cannot know, because we may not know the direction in which a man is passing, and in a way he may be passing around the wheel in both directions simultaneously. His form may be continuing in the clockwise direction, and his consciousness may be beginning to move in the counterclockwise direction. And I think what is important is to reach that point in development when a true reversal of the wheel occurs, as some theorists have thought, really maybe after the decision in the desert, maybe after the midway point between the second and third initiation. It is something that can be thought about. When the form also is no longer traveling on the clockwise wheel, but the form as well is traveling counterclockwise and is rising in its power. The elemental is changing into the deva, and the form is being transmuted, transformed, transfigured, and is no longer fighting or resisting the counterclockwise trend of consciousness. He's going to have a lot to say here about the decanates in Aquarius, because it's so important, because we are entering at this time the Aquarian age. And what he's going to tell us is important not only for the individual, but as well for all of humanity. Since Aquarius is one of the major group signs, and it is in Aquarius that humanity will begin to realize itself as one entity. What I'll do is go through what DK has said, and then I'll look at this table of decanates, which has been prepared in some esoteric astrology classes with a lot of contribution on extra zodiacal constellations from Nicholas Nilen, who is we've been collaborators in teaching astrology, and he has some unique perspectives on astrology, really. And then I'll go through a six-fold chart which I prepared to try to look at the effect of the decanates, decanate rulers, at different stages of consciousness. See, what we have to do is we have to look at the orthodox, esoteric, and hierarchical rulers, how they operate at different stages of consciousness, remembering that when we move towards an esoteric ruler, we do not entirely transcend, but we appropriate in a new way the exoteric ruler. And when we move towards the hierarchical ruler, it's not that we leave the other two types behind, but we incorporate them in the larger perspective that is given to us when we function under the hierarchical ruler. So we remain inclusive. We are not exclusive. We're not in some artificial linear way moving from point to point to point and no longer relating to the points we have passed. So it is, you know, when I look at it, it's a lot of fusing and blending is required to look at this whole issue of rulerships, how they should be applied at different stages of development, and how the rulers of decanates should be applied at those stages of development as well, and how it is that there can be more than one ruler of a decanate operating at different levels, some purely exoterically and some more esoterically. So, you know, I think we cannot bring complete clarity to the subject, however much some might assert that they can. I don't think it's exactly possible, but we will proceed. The decanates in Aquarius are governed, according to Alan Leo, which is usually DK's favorite, by Saturn, Mercury, and Venus, meaning, since these particular astrologers did not think in terms of reversing the wheel and moving from 30 to 20 to 10 to 0, when they list the decanates are always listed according to the natural order of things counterclockwise. Saturn 0 to 10, Mercury 10 to 20, and Venus 20 to 30. And the effect that they will produce upon human affairs and world conditions is already beginning to appear, because we are definitely in that overlap stage where the age of Aquarius has begun to make its pressure felt. It may have begun in the days of Francis Bacon or in the days of HBB and the founding of the TS, but whichever of those two options we choose, it is definitely here with us now, as the Piscean influence will be entirely gone at some point in the 21st century. So, you know, if we go here and we look at the decanates here in the landscape view, and let's see, going down. Okay, maybe I can do this a little faster this way. Going down here to Aquarius. Okay. Right. So we see that, you know, what I'd like to do, is make this just a little more visible. What I'd like to do is take this out and put it right here above Aquarius, so that we don't have to go hunting as we are discussing. Okay, and I think I've accomplished that now. Right. So, here we are. Okay, so we have Alan Leo's point of view of Saturn, Mercury, and Venus. He may have occasionally used some trans-Saturnian planets. DK tends not to do that. So in this tabulation, we have the zodiacal constellation, we have the extra zodiacal constellation which may be associated with it, we have elaborated comments, we have DK's assignment on the Wheel of Consciousness, and then we have the reversal of the Wheel of Consciousness, which could be considered to be the Wheel of Form, but it's not always so. And then this is the Wheel of Form as Nicholas Nilén, NN, conceives it to be. So there are some differences. And here is Alan Leo, and here is Safariel, who is using the Chaldean method, which begins with the period of Saturn and then moves inward, Jupiter, Mars, Sun, Venus, Mercury, Moon, and so forth. Okay. So we'll be able to come back to this and won't have to go searching. This will work fine. So let's see what he says. The decanates of Aquarius are governed, according to Alan Leo, by Saturn, Mercury, and Venus, and the effect that they will produce upon human affairs and world conditions is already beginning to appear. We are, we would not have discovered atomic energy unless we were in the Aquarian age. So let's hope here. I'm having a little difficulty. Okay, let's see. I'll see. Okay, so here we are again. Sometimes text tends to disappear. All right, hopefully this will be right. The decanates in Aquarius are governed by Saturn, Mercury, and Venus, and I was showing you the view of Aquarius from the point of view of Cesario, Alan Leo, Nicholas Nolan's version, what the Tibetan appears to have given. I have to say appears to have given because sometimes there's some ambiguity there, and different astrologers interpret this differently than the reversal of the Tibetan's method. The particular constellation involved in the sub-constellation, the extra zodiacal constellation, and little comments upon the extra zodiacal constellation. Okay, moving back then to this Saturn. Then we're looking at Saturn, Mercury, and Venus for the first, second, and third decanate, although in a way they would be reversed, quite literally. Venus, Mercury, and Saturn for the average individual traveling in the clockwise manner. Saturn is the planet of discipleship, one of the planets of discipleship, along with Mercury, and of opportunity. Opportunity to face karmic necessity and overcome it. It is exceedingly active today. This is the middle of the 20th century, and I don't think there's been any difference in the activity of Saturn. It's still extremely active. Yes. It is exceedingly active today, presenting to the world disciple, meaning humanity considered as the world disciple, but perhaps also presenting to the initiate of the third degree, who can be considered a world disciple, those difficult situations and crises which will involve free choice. And of course, they will, when rightly faced, they will strengthen the individual and the group. Discriminative pioneering, wise response, and correct decision, thus bringing about the destruction of that which hinders, without the relinquishing of any of the true values of which humanity may be aware. What a wonderful part of a sentence here. If we want to really understand what Saturn is, we look at this sentence. Very active today, exceedingly active today, presenting to the world disciple those difficult situations, oftentimes obstructions, things that are hard to get beyond unless one uses one's not only intelligence, but unitive intelligence, soul-infused intelligence, and crises, which will involve free choice. So the man or the group has the opportunity to decide which type of values to promote. It will involve free choice. Discriminative pioneering, not just lunging ahead towards some new idea, but will discriminate about the possible paths that may be taken if the individual or the group really wants to move ahead according to the divine plan. Wise and, I would say, balanced response, as Saturn is the lord of balance, and correct decision, always in line with the will of the soul for the individual or the group, thus bringing about the destruction. Saturn is the destructive. It's a first-rate planet. It puts a lot of pressure on things. They collapse, thus bringing about the destruction of that which hinders. Not only is Saturn that which hinders, but it's the destruction of that which hinders. And interpreting which is which, of course, is one of the fine arts. Every time there is an obstacle, there is a possibility of overcoming or destroying that obstacle. Bringing about the destruction of that which hinders without relinquishing any of the true values of which humanity may be aware, because these are found not so much in forms per se, but in consciousness. So obstructive forms may be destroyed to the benefit of consciousness, which has chosen correctly, and which therefore can expand, because the destructive objects are no longer hindering. The individual disciple has always been faced with these conditioning and releasing circumstances, because Saturn is, under the third ray, very much the planet of conditioning. It is actuality, how things are in the world of illusion. It's not necessarily reality, but some people call the actual the real, which is not the case. The individual disciple has always been faced with these conditioning and releasing circumstances, if the conditioning is properly faced and wise choices made. And today, humanity itself, humanity the world disciple, one day to become the world first degree initiate, even though not all of its members will take that initiation, and humanity itself is in the same position. We stand at the gateway of the new world and of the new age and its new civilizations, not just one, ideals and culture, common values, values held in common but expressed through many different civilizational forms and through various ideals. Okay, moving on. Saturn, having offered opportunity to overcome the obstacles and proffered us, it's another fancier name for offered, proffered us a choice to bring about the needed changes, because they will not be brought about unless we choose wisely. Instinctively, we are not, as a human race, going to make those proper choices. Proffered us a choice to bring about the needed changes and to destroy that which holds back the free expression of the soul, because indeed so many of us are imprisoned in the forms which we have made or the forms which others have made and which serve as our environment. Saturn eventually stands aside, or at least, shall we say, the individual refocuses on another stream of energy. Saturn eventually stands aside in order to let his great brother Mercury spread the light of the soul. Spread the light of the soul, intuitive and illuminating upon the situation. And this will come some 720 years approximately into the Aquarian Age, with Saturn in general having ruled the first 720 years. We're looking at the idea of 2160 years being the duration of a precessional age. So Saturn stands aside to let his great brother Mercury spread the light of the soul, intuitive and illuminating upon the situation, to interpret for us through our own illumined minds. We have the mind then held steady in the light, the significance of events, and to relate the old and the new. This is a fourth ray technique under the new group of world servers, which is very much ruled by Mercury and by Taurus, the significance of events, and to relate the old and the new, the past and the future, through the light of the present. So we have Mercury somehow, that's not going to do, is it? We have Mercury involved in what we might call the eternal now, which is very much achieved in relation to the fourth ray and the Buddhic plane. That the fourth ray somehow ruling the present moment between the past and the future. So let's read that again, because I'll try to do that without my own interruptions here. After Saturn has proffered us a choice to bring about the needed changes and to destroy that which holds back the free expression of the soul, he eventually stands aside in order to let his great brother, Mercury, spread the light of the soul, intuitive and illuminating upon the situation, to interpret for us through our own illumined minds the significance of events, and to relate the old and the new, the past and the future, through the light of the present. So Mercury is bringing in, let's see, Mercury, put it like that, Mercury bringing in the eternal, no, to interpret for us our own luminous mind, significance of events, relate the old new, yeah, he's bringing in the fourth ray. He's bringing in the power of meaning, the power of meaning, and of later significance. Meaning being the type of understanding of which the soul is capable, and significance, the deeper understanding which is revealed when the consciousness is focused within the spiritual triad, where Mercury also holds an important place. So it's not only dealing with circumstances, it's not only eliminating obstacles, doing that hard work of getting rid of the obstructions, it's also understanding from a non-illusory perspective what really is happening. And this will be a very high point of manas, some hundreds of years ahead, and that manas will not just be concrete manas for so many of the disciples of the world, but will be illumined by soul light and also by triadal radiance. Well, okay. There's one more thing to say here. Hence the subjective usefulness of the present general trend towards meditation, which is very much ruled by Mercury in the meditative process, as ruled by the zodiacal signs, is ruled by Virgo, which is ruled by Mercury. So Mercury is involved in the meditation processes. Hence the subjective usefulness, in order to help us enter into the world of meaning and significance, of the present general trend towards meditation processes, which bring about the capacity to be impressed from on high, Mercury being a planet of conveyance, conveying impression from the high to the low and from the low to the high, the capacity to be impressed from on high, technically understood, and to be illumined by the light of the soul. Mercury, the planet of illumination. Okay, now moving on a little. When the task of Saturn and of Mercury has been accomplished, then during the third decanate, a time some 1,440 years from the beginning of the Aquarian Age, but remember, always with overlaps. It's not just that Saturn suddenly ends its influence and Venus, Mercury begins its, and then Venus begins its influence. It's not that at all. There are these overlapping periods, and those hard and fast lines of demarcation are not not really present, not really realities. When the task of Mercury, Saturn and Mercury, has been accomplished, then during the third decanate, Venus, which is or signifies the union of heart and mind, that's one of those important definitions of Venus. Venus, which is the union of heart and mind, will usher in the long hoped for era of love, wisdom, of brotherhood, and expressed brotherly relationships. This is really interesting because the majority of humanity, as DK will tell us, those who are on the clockwise wheel, are entering the age of Aquarius via Venus. And so when they are looking at what Aquarius should bring for us, we have all of those anticipations of a Venusian life, harmony and understanding, you know, in the song, The Age of Aquarius, the expectation is very Venusian, Jupiterian, very benevolent, and we don't understand the tremendous rigors and challenges that the Aquarian energy could put us through. And this is simply because, well, the majority is coming in via Venus, and as a result, we have all of these issues now coming up with relationship and what are truly loving relationships, and do they have to conform to tradition or not, because Aquarius, being Uranian sign, is a very non-traditional sign. So we're trying to work out all kinds of issues of what love means, and you know, free love, the summer of love, the hippie movement, all of that. It's all very Aquarian, but coming in via Venus. It's certainly not coming in via Saturn, is it? But of course, it will not be the predominating influence until the era of brotherly love and true love wisdom supervenes well after the beginning of the Age of Aquarius, some almost 1,500 years after the beginning of the Age of Aquarius. So that is the period towards which we are really looking with hopeful anticipation, but we will have many other kinds of experiences over a long time and quite a number of incarnations, most of us, before we reach that point of truly expressed love, wisdom. So what do we have? And he's giving us these keynotes for the planets. We have Opportunity, which is Saturn Illumination, Mercury, and Brotherhood, which is Venus. And if you think about it, you know, Venus is the esoteric ruler of Gemini. And Gemini, we have the two brothers, and the right relation between these two brothers is governed very much by Venus. So it will be a time when Venus is ruling, when it brings in esoterically the influence of Gemini. See, always remember that the planets have a relationship to different signs, and depending upon whether we are considering them in a normal, esoteric, or hierarchical manner, the influence of different signs will be drawn in. From another perspective, if you look at this Age of Brotherhood, well, okay, it's bringing in the Libran influence, meaning that right human relations, and Taurus, the illumination will continue. And it's also bringing in Gemini for true brotherhood, and it's bringing in hierarchically Capricorn, and so one suspects that during that age, it will be also an age in which many will be initiated. What initiation will it be? Well, second or third initiation for quite a few. So Opportunity, Illumination, and Brotherhood, these are the gifts that Shambhala, who is planning everything, really, and directing everything, is planning to confer upon humanity during the Aquarian Age, if man will but prepare for them. See, the gifts are offered, but will the gifts be accepted? Will the gifts be assimilated? It takes our own free will to actually incorporate, take in, utilize what is being given to us. Gifts can be ignored. Gifts can be rejected. So we do have a deep responsibility here in relation to the descending gifts. If man will but prepare for them, accept them, and use them. Now, that's, and thus it is for the individual as well. You know, so many things are showering upon us. Are we alert enough to realize what they are and assimilate them and use them? Only the future will make clear man's reaction. It's always possible to go in the wrong direction. Choice is always ours, and especially under Saturn. Think about all those choices we're going to be faced with during the Aquarian age, where tremendous energies are going to be liberated, and we have to make decisions about how we are going to use those energies. It will be really an era of a strong responsibility, and it will not end, if you think of it. Even after the era of brotherly love, we will have an age of Capricorn, an age of Capricorn. And that in that age of Capricorn, I suspect that, let's just take a look here. We'll take a look, and we will see that in Capricorn, Saturn is the ruler of the first decanate. So we again will be presented with Saturn plus the double Saturn rulership. Okay, that's 2,300 years ahead. And we have a lot on our plate before that time. But Saturn is the disciple's friend. And if we're going to actually serve the divine plan, which is very atmic, very Saturnian, we're going to have to learn to have a very obedient relationship with this great planet of discipleship, this planet of Brahma, this oldest, in a way, of the synthesizing planets, oldest at least in expression, though not necessarily oldest in essence. Okay, now let's see what else. Okay, we have this malfunctioning, that's what else. Okay, all right. According to other astrologers, the three decanates are governed by Venus, Mercury, and the Moon. And let's just take a look. Who are these other astrologers? Well, here is our Aquarian setup. Yeah, Venus, Mercury, and the Moon, moving inward as the periods of the duration of the orbit of the Sun, of the Earth, rather, the apparent orbit of the Earth, decreases. Venus with a greater period than Mercury, and Mercury with a greater period than the Moon, which moves really very fast. So he is talking about Sephiria, isn't he? So let's see here. According to other astrologers, the three decanates are governed by Venus, Mercury, and the Moon. He doesn't entirely discount them. Now remember that Sephiria is talking about, according to his view, the first, second, and third decanate. Now, in a way, it would make sense to, if the third decanate is ruled by the Moon, we would enter the last 30 degrees first on the reverse wheel, and we would begin with the Moon experience first, move to the Mercury experience, and then the Venus experience. You can see here the relation of astrology to the normal or to the reversed wheel of life. Now, DK is going to contrast this Saturn-Mercury-Venus with Venus-Mercury-Moon. And the way it lines up is that Venus rules the same decanate as Saturn. Mercury is identical. And then the Moon rules the same decanate as Venus. So you can see here the relation of astrology to the normal or to the reversed wheel of life. The Moon here takes the place of Saturn and hides Uranus. Now, this is very important in a way, because the Moon is the first decanate for the average individual, and Saturn is the first decanate for the disciple. Let's put this down. Sometimes when you're studying the decanates, you don't know whether you're coming or going, but let's just say the Moon rules the first decan for the average individual, and Saturn the first decan for the disciple. Okay, well, he's going to make a specific point here. The Moon, which here takes the place of Saturn, hides the planet Uranus. And in this case, Uranus The occult planet is not operating as high as it might. It's operating in a more exoteric manner. It is the occult planet, but it has an exoteric expression. In this case, Uranus, the occult planet, stands for exoteric science, which penetrates into the hidden side of form life. There's your moon, see? The penetration is Uranian, and the form is lunar. Uranus rules the penetration, and moon the form which is penetrated. And thus we have the period wherein man is not alert enough or conscious enough to seize the opportunity, which is Saturn. Remember, Saturn is here substituted for the moon, and turn it to esoteric or soul ends, but can at least identify himself with the more advanced aspects of form. And this he does by scientific research, scientific inquiry. Using Uranus, which is a scientific planet. The energy which produces opportunity, illumination, and brotherly love as expressed and attained upon the fixed cross. Opportunity, illumination, and brotherly love. So it's Saturn, Mercury, and Venus as expressed upon the fixed cross, demonstrates upon the mutable cross as, mutable to common cross, as difficulty. So Saturn is still operative. He's not getting rid of it. The versatile, volatile mind and sex. So, okay. We have here a complex presentation, and we are noticing that the Tibetan is not dismissing Saturn, Mercury, and Venus. In fact, he is reversing them, and he's saying, here is sex under Venus, here is the versatile and darkened mind, and here simply is difficulty. So he says, yes, it's legitimate to reverse these, and he will discuss this, here's what he does. Safariel gives us Venus and Mercury, and this corresponds very much with the reversal that the Tibetan is giving us. Over here we have Venus in the first place, entering through Venus, and Venus is same with Safariel, and the moon is taking the place of Saturn, and it's connected, in this case, with the third decanate, but really with the first decanate. And yet the way Safariel set it up, this is where the complexity enters in. Safariel set up the moon in relation to 20 to 30 degrees, but DK is moving in a reversed manner and seems to find it legitimate to put Venus from 30 to 20 degrees, entered first, Mercury entered second from 20 to 10, and the moon entered third, as if the moon, taking the place of Saturn and indicating Uranus, can stand for 10 degrees to 0 degrees. So I think you can see that when you're trying to pin down exactly where these rulers belong, DK feels free to start from both directions, and only in the very middle of the sign, where we can see right across the board here, it's Mercury all the way, can we have real certainty. Otherwise, it seems possible to have the ruler of the first decanate, as Safariel conceives it to be, operating in relation to the third decanate of the normal wheel, and the ruler of the third decanate operating in relation to the first decanate of the normal wheel. Anyway, we will come back to this. As always, I think when dealing with the decanates, one wants to know whether one is coming or going, and I will try to continue to explain this coming and going when we enter Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 65. Right now, we're operating here after 1 hour and 15 minutes. I think that's probably a good time to call it. EAA number 64 from page 146 to what? To looks like page 150. Okay. 150 and 1 hour and 15 minutes. And when I try to put down an hour, I get the human race. Okay. So now we will have the great invocation, as we always do. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Everyone, we're right in the middle of the decanates, and finding out there are more than one way to look at the rulers of the decanates. Yes, because as I say, even though Safariel started with Venus, he didn't mean for Venus to rule 20 to 30, he meant for it to rule 0 to 10. He did mean Mercury to rule 20 to 10 to 20, but when he dealt with the moon, he didn't mean that it should rule 0 to 10, the way the Tibetan seems to indicate as a substitute for Saturn. He meant, so far, he meant that it rules, what does he say? Yeah, rules 20 to 30. So there are alternative assignments we can make, and we'll try to. When DK calls it fluid, it certainly is fluid. All right, well, more on this when we continue, and we will sign off at this time, starting next with Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 65. Okay, we'll see you then.